This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello, and welcome to Better Places, the podcast from Consilio, where we talk about planning, politics, and development from all across London. Today, we have a special episode where our very own Sidhu Dwyer interviews industry professionals from across the planning and property sectors. We were delighted to host Andy Cox, Director at Trigon DM, Kat Fraser, Director at Turley, and Aaron Taggart, Head of UK Investment at Cheyne Capital. A compelling discussion was had today on a broad range of topics from scheme viability to engaging communities and navigating the intricacies of planning and real estate in London.
My name is Sidhu Dwyer, an account director here at Consilio, leading our engagement work in most of London's boroughs. On our pod, we explore the intersection of London politics, planning and property development. Today, we're thrilled to be joined by three brilliant guests. While I usually interview political leaders and local government professionals facilitating and delivering growth, our guests today each bring a wealth of experience and insight from their development, investment and technical planning expertise. I'm joined by Andy Cox, co-founder of Trigon DM. He has a remarkable background in delivering complex real estate projects across residential, commercial, hotel and student accommodation sectors. Since co-founding Trigon in 2020, Andy has been instrumental in managing high-value developments across London with a keen interest on sustainability and transparency. Trigon's portfolio includes multi-million pound projects that promote strong environmental and social benefits, earning the company a B Corp accreditation that recognises their high standards for social environmental principles, transparency and accountability. Andy's leadership, I'm sure you'd agree, ensures that each project not only meets clients' expectations, but also delivers long-term value for communities. Welcome, Andy.
Nice to see you, Sidhu.
And Kat Fraser, Director at Turley, has extensive experience of over 15 years in navigating London's intricate planning landscape. She's led on key urban regeneration projects, contributing to the city's evolving infrastructure and its housing needs, delivering thousands of new homes and a network of transport and social facilities to connect them. Turley's projects are known for their scale and complexity, particularly in the residential and mixed-use sectors here in the capital. Kat also serves as the NLA Industrial and Logistics Expert Panel Chair, quite the title, placing her at the helm of discussions on one of the capital's most critical sectors, industrial space, that makes us more competitive in the logistics space and can unlock new housing. As e-commerce and supply chain demands rise, her thought and leadership in this space ensures that London's industrial developments meet the needs of the future. Welcome, Kat.
Thank you for that.
We're also joined by Aaron Taggart, who heads the UK real estate investment team at Cheyne Capital, one of Europe's largest alternative asset managers. With over two decades of experience, Aaron is responsible for managing a significant portfolio, with Cheyne lending across Europe's nations and its regions, with over 100 global investors and $6 billion in Cheyne's real estate strategy. His role includes structuring finance solutions for large-scale either residential, commercial and industrial developments. And Cheyne is renowned for its versatility and ability to support ambitious projects. Aaron's deep expertise in navigating investment risks and opportunities makes him a vital figure, not just here in the UK, but across the continent's real estate funding landscape. London's planning and development environment is undergoing significant changes, and our conversation comes at quite a significant and critical time. The upcoming Labour government's budget on the 30th of October is expected to introduce far-reaching policy shifts from Chancellor Rachel Reeves and Sir Keir Starmer that have put wealth creation and growth at the heart of its budget, with a renewed focus on improving the economy to fund public services and boosting the supply of new housing, future-proofing the nation's infrastructure and guaranteeing environmental sustainability. The property sector is preparing for long-awaited relaxation in planning rules, long-awaited in my view too, potential incentives for a green revolution and reforms that could accelerate the approval process for major projects often stymied by the blockers. The government is also likely to introduce new funding mechanisms for infrastructure that could support new housing delivery, new affordable and social housing, and possibly changes to land, particularly Greenbelt,
and property taxation aimed at fostering inclusive growth. So in today's episode, we'll discuss how our guests are navigating these challenges, how they're preparing for the anticipated policy shifts, and the strategies they've employed to succeed in an increasingly complex market. From overcoming planning hurdles to aligning investment decisions with public sector expectations, we'll explore the key milestones in their careers, some of their most significant projects, and their vision for the future of development here in London. So here we go. Let's uncover the real stories behind delivering successful developments in one of the world's most dynamic cities and get into the discussion with our guests. I'm going to start with you, Andy. And we know that Trigon has been managing Bloom's Next Zero projects in places like Greenwich and Camberwell. I wonder if you could share your insights on what it takes to make, in my view, a crack multidisciplinary team, quite a mouthful there, in London's 2024 property market. How do you guide the projects from design through to pre-app and to application and build out, especially with an increased focus on environmental sustainability and social value?
Quite the question, Zulu. Our journey with the Bloom guys started back in 2021. We've now got 6 projects on the go with the guys, be it feasibility through to completing the works on site. And when we set out, sort of the ultimate goal was all around delivering climate neutral buildings and aligning those buildings with the requirements of the Paris Agreement and the commitments made there, but also the London Plan Zero Carbon City goal. So there were sort of 2 key drivers behind the strategy working with Bloom. You know, the first being sort of across the European funding market, assets under management in it, who are Article 8 and Article 9 aligned, being green funds. Back in 2021, that was sort of 42% of the total quantum. And as of Q2 this year, that's over 60% now. So there's a real shift towards investment needing green and sustainable outcomes, and that being a defined factor. And the second piece was having now tangible tenant demands. Again, back in 23, some of the studies with the likes of JLL, Knight Frank, CBRE, etc., they're throwing out that over 60%, about 63% of UK industrial and logistics occupiers, they've all committed to net zero targets by 2030 as well. So we had a very clear path that we needed to go down and some defined goals we needed to achieve. So in terms of starting to build the team, one of our key challenges was around the alignment and finding a commonality in the language across the different political, legislative, regulatory, funder, tenant goals, all these different work streams that were pushing in the same direction but had perhaps a different language attached to them. For example, if you ask 10 people in a room what is ESG or what's a sustainable building, you will more than likely get 10 different answers. So we looked at the EU taxonomy, which is the framework that essentially governs the deployment of capital through a green fund, an Article 8 or Article 9 fund. That they are underpinned by 6 environmental objectives, and below that are some technical screening criteria, which is a detail around how are you going to achieve these sustainable outcomes. And ultimately, the framework we saw is providing clarity and consistency to those sustainable standards, and it seemed a good way to bring all those different pieces together in the room. So we set about with the Bloom guys, setting the brief for the schemes. We started underpinning it with the taxonomy requirements, i.e. making this an investable product to these green funds. We layered on top where we are with planning policy and regulation in terms of building regs, and then layered on top what tenants were asking for. And we built a matrix that showed the commonality between those in terms of what we needed to deliver to satisfy all these requirements. We then built a team with those goals and targets, and we were able to go out and find and work within our network of peers and consultants, of people who had similar ambitions and they had the expertise to deliver upon these specific goals. And then we worked forward through the technical stages, designed, taking it through planning and measuring against these targets. And as we were able to use the early bit of work that we did around the alignment to talk to the planners in Greenwich, talk to the planners in Lambeth about how these align, how our outputs were delivering on their policy requirements, and knitting the whole piece together. So I suppose in terms of key drivers through the whole process, that alignment and defining relatable outcomes really underpinned what we were able to do, and making those outcomes relatable to all parties, regulatory, legislative, tenant base, etc. And the second piece was around the demonstrable evidence and making sure we were able to demonstrate compliance against these through all the stages of the project, be it reporting to a fund level, talking to the planners, engaging with stakeholders in the community, and making sure we were able to demonstrate we were delivering on benefit for everyone involved.
Oh, thank you so much. And I mean, there's so much to unpack there, but I wonder on that kind of demonstration piece, where for not just members and council officers that you're working with, but for the community, how you saw the kind of delivery on some of those kind of key aspects of that scheme. How do you keep your team to the promises that you've made, and how do you make sure that the commitments that were made during planning are kind of fulfilled?
So I think there's probably a few strands to that. At a technical level, it's a slightly easier compliance piece. It's about setting very technical targets and the team working through those and reporting against them. I think part of the journey was turning the outputs into things that all stakeholders could relate to, be they in the community or, for example, within Lambeth or Greenwich themselves, and making sure we could communicate that we were moving forward and delivering on their specific requirements.
And I wonder if I could turn to you, Aaron. Obviously, they've mentioned quite a complex environment that many industry professionals have to work with in London, but also in the UK. And with the upcoming budget, the first Labour budget in 14 years, we're expecting Chancellor Rachel Rees to introduce and to continue liberalising planning guidance and laws, whilst I feel and rightly increasing amounts for either affordable and social housing schemes. As someone who's worked in this sector for such a long time, and you're assessing risk and trying to manage the expectations of some of your clients, but also thinking about the commercial benefits that they could accrue, what are the signals that the government are sending to the market? Do you think that these are signals that are anticipated to increase complexities, or is this the kind of right balance that you're seeing among some global investors?
I think I'll start off in relation to answering that question by saying that I think this is an incredibly exciting time and moment for a number of reasons, both economic and political. But on the political side, I think the fact that they've got a plan is great. The fact that it's forward thinking and ambitious, again, it reminds me a little bit of what it was like pre-Olympics, which was a really exciting time, but tinged with fear. The fear of failure, the fear of we're not going to be good enough, the fear of not delivering. And it feels a little bit like that, but as an investor that invests a relatively significant amount of capital into London, into the UK, and into wider Europe, I find this a really exciting period to be an investor, because I think Labour's plan, one of the levers they're going to pull is house building. And why is that? Well, it makes absolute economic sense, and it hits a number of their points that they're going to want to achieve in this first term. You know, I don't want to be too political, but if they do deliver, there's a good chance they get second term. So they've got a big mandate at the moment as well, which I think is incredibly important, because they can shift the dial. So if you think about why they want to shift the needle on housing in particular, and what the potential blockages are going to be, but let's talk about the upside immediately. So one is just GDP growth. You know, we need to grow ourselves out of this predicament. You know, they have been left with a very tight fiscal position. Yeah, it is not easy trying to square the circle of investing and tax and how they're going to raise capital to invest. It's not easy, and I do not underestimate the challenge that they have, but definitely one of the levers they can pull is house building and encouraging the private sector to unlock some of the stalled schemes and just the industry in general. If you think about it, the way I think about the London and UK landscape is, if you fast forward to Q1 2025, if you look back over the preceding 5 years, you're going back to Q1 2020. In that time, what have we had to deal with? We've had to deal with COVID. Then we've had to Straight after COVID, you're almost straight away into Ukraine, Russia, you're straight into inflation, you're straight into interest rates, values coming down. In that period, I think we've been building for 1 year out of five. And that's at a time where we've had record net migration into this country.
Mm.
Well, it shouldn't be surprising to anyone that there's fierce rent inflation around at the moment,
mm.
because no one is getting onto the ladder. You've got more and more people living in the country. At the same time, you're not building enough homes. It's not that complex. It's relatively straightforward why we're seeing fierce rent inflation. So that leads me on to the second point of what Labour are trying to achieve here. One of the only ways you're going to be able to address affordability is by building more homes. Yeah, not by building less homes. You know, more people living in this country, same amount of houses, rent inflation. It's a relatively straightforward economic argument. So you're going to have to just build more homes. And going back to one of the other points you made about Greenbelt, etc., I don't necessarily think we have to stampede away with the Greenbelt.
Mm.
Yeah, we still have low-hanging fruit in London. Yeah, let's hit those. So we're talking as investors who have invested into places like King's Cross with Argent, as
mm.
was Argent back in the day, Brentcross Town now with related Argent as it is now, with Quintain over at Wembley. You know, we've seen successful, and Stratford, I could go on and on, but we've seen successful large-scale development happen in London. And as such, I think, you know, we're not reinventing the wheel here. This is not beyond the wit of the intellect that we have
mm.
in the country and in London in particular. We should be able to unlock the potential that we have.
No,
so that's definitely, you know, this is a huge positive, but we've got to maintain the momentum that we currently have. I think there has definitely been a, as far as UK PLC is concerned, there's definitely, we are now on the global map from capital that says UK is a place that we'd like to invest. So I think we need to take advantage of the momentum that we currently have.
No, massively. And I will come back just on that point, especially kind of learning lessons from the international markets. But I wonder if I could bring Kat Fraser in just on the Greenbelt point, or indeed trying to utilise land that we have available to us in the inner city. I mean, it's no secret, Kat, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the UK's planning system's outdated. Its site-by-site planning policy environment makes it so difficult to kind of navigate all of these contradictory policies. We've got in on the outskirts of London disused car parks and shrubland that makes up a lot of our green belt and perhaps redesignated to grey belt. And then we've got lots of brownfield sites that we could utilise. I wonder, as a planner, in your perspective, how do you kind of navigate this complex system to deliver new homes? Are these housing targets that London has that revised for it, are they going to keep up with elements of kind of mass migration that was alluded to by Aaron there? And what are your clients' views on the government's new signals regarding potential changes to our planning policy?
It is a minefield, and I think we're almost at a point where we are a bit deaf by policy, but that's where we are. But it is all change at the moment, and I think just, I suppose, starting at the last of your question in terms of what are the discussions I'm having, what are my clients seeing at the moment, especially with all the wealth of draft policy that's coming out at a national level. And I think, as Aaron intimated a bit, there is some cautious optimism around it. There has been some clear signals from the government that they are going to put a lot of pressure on councils and the mayor from a London level to bring forward housing and actually get housing out the ground, actually get delivery going. And I think the government has, I suppose, shown its direction of travel with the call-ins that they've already made, and showing that they will call in planning applications and they will make decisions quickly if they feel that there is that need. There's another a good example of councils taking on that direction of travel, understanding where the government is coming from and knowing that they need to get moving, is with the John Lewis appeal in West Ealing, where that was appealed non-determination, inquiry due to start in November, and Ealing have said that they will not be contesting. They pulled out the appeal. Now, the inquiry is still going ahead because they've got a third party, an amenity group, that will still be acting against John Lewis. However, the reason why Ealing's pulled out is because of the draft MPPF and said it would be a waste of taxpayers' money to contest this further. So I think there is a clear signal coming from the government that, you know, housing delivery is the utmost. In terms of, I suppose, seeing that change across London, from that national perspective, there does need to be more of a shift at the local level, and taking those cues that are coming through. And I think a lot of that is that pressure on affordable housing. I do think that, you know, Birmingham's apparently they're consulting on bringing that down to 20-25%, and I think there's a consensus of, you know, the minimum 35% that we've got in London at the moment, it's not working. We've worked on our own scheme in a London borough where it was council's housing delivery vehicle, where we got to the 35%, got to 50% actually, sorry, with public land, and they can't build it. So they got the 50%, it's not deliverable. And then you have to get to the point where a percentage of nothing is not good. So 20% of something is better than a percentage of nothing.
I see the other panelists nodding along there. I think you have some agreement in the kind of complexities there.
There's a lot more I could go through.
Just to unpack that, and perhaps combine a question I had just thought of there, which I refer to as veto points, but perhaps you could explain it a bit better to some of our listeners, where you'd mentioned there that you had the scheme that you presented to your local authority, then you had to compete with the mayor's priorities, and then you'd also had a call in that the Labour government's also trying to utilise in the same way that Michael Gove and his predecessors have. I wondered your specialty around industrial land and kind of meeting housing need. How do you navigate that? How do you kind of present a scheme to a local council that might be in favour, but the mayor has different priorities, then the Secretary of State then gets in? How can we kind of meet the housing needs that we have, whilst also trying to navigate an expansion and kind of retention of industrial space, for instance?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a massive demand for both, and I think even more so since the pandemic on the industrial side. So that there is a pressure on housing, but there's also an increasing spotlight on industrial and logistics space. And I think that brought around the mayor's policy in London of the possibility of co-locating both uses. It is maybe seen as a bit of having your cake and eating it in terms of amalgamating the two uses. And there is perhaps a place for this. So Tarley has been producing research on this, and we have just produced our third year of research at the beginning of this year, where we look at all the co-location schemes that are coming through in the capital. Now, what I suppose we have seen is that there is a lot of, there's a large number of major strategic co-location schemes that have planning permission, but what we've not seen is delivery, and therefore how successful that product is. The stats that we've got show that about 50% of these schemes are being implemented at the moment, with about 30% being constructed, but we're yet to see one that's fully built out. So there is still a nervousness around whether it works, maybe a bit sceptical still, but I do think that that product is right in the right place. And I think that's dependent on making sure that it's in the right industrial area that's already going to that creative industry side that is more compatible with housing. If you know, but what we're seeing in our report is where co-location has happened is that that harder industrial, the B8 industrial warehousing, has gone down by 30% in those locations.
Oh, wow.
And that the softer industrial, the creative side, artist studios, has gone up by about 50% in these schemes. And that seems obvious. But then is this product coming forward at the consequence of the actual industrial uses that we need? So it's right place, right area, and I think that's a really hard balance in the policy framework that we're in with the pressures on both uses that we've got.
No, I can only imagine. And I'd like to bring Andy in before I kind of move over to Aaron, just on that kind of viability point and matching up the kind of policy compliance that you have to navigate. How do you square that hole? As a person who's kind of crunching the numbers with these schemes, how is it difficult at the moment in the market, and what are you advising your teams to try and make sure that schemes are deliverable, but also delivering on the commercial and social benefits, and are those two mutually exclusive?
I think viability is a well-publicised challenge in the industry, at the coal phase all the way through to the number of homes we're ultimately able to deliver at the moment through economic pressures within industry and society itself, construction cost inflation, labour challenges. There's a lot that comes into this, and it takes a long time for a lot of that economic shift to work its way down into land values and for those to normalise, so that adds another stress to it. We all know housing delivery is key, and it's very, very high up on the agenda. And we've got the Affordable Housing Programme, which is focused on that delivery. But sometimes there's a slight disconnect in the quality or the standard of those homes that are delivered. We have the Future Home Standard, and there are a few questions about the long-term sustainability, perhaps, that delivers. And that just adds another sort of level of complexity to the equation. Some of the challenges we see through the viability piece, there's some more straightforward that Kat's touched on there. 20% of nothing is better than 0%. Sorry, 20% of something is better than 0% of nothing, which
I think
is a great phrase. But there's challenges around the inefficiency sometimes of the process and the guidance and policies that sit behind the decisions that are sometimes taken. I think co-living's a good example of that. PBSL, which arguably a stabilised sector now in a big sector in the London economy.
For our listeners, would you mind unpacking that acronym there?
Sorry, so PBSL, Purpose Built Shared Living, more widely known as co-living, which we're seeing across, and Aaron, I know, is heavily involved in that sector as well. But we're seeing there a slight conflict with policy, where it's a rapidly evolving market, and where we've got to with the GLA guidance earlier this year, defining certain requirements around amenity, etc., which were all well-meaning and linked back to the early development of that product, perhaps aren't now relatable to the market. So we have schemes going forward and being delivered that potentially is costing money to deliver elements that aren't going to be used by the tenants and could be deployed in other areas. So viability doesn't just sit in our head at a pure sort of percentage and what can be delivered. It's about the product as well. The other piece we've been looking at and has been in the press a lot lately is around the contributions. The calculation of that is one piece and an expensive process to go through, but the press in the last couple of weeks about the $8 billion of unspent contributions that are allegedly sitting in council accounts across the country, and allegedly around $820 million of that affordable housing contributions, and six of the top 10 councils allegedly being sitting in London with that unspent. So,
which I've read that report, and of that £817 million, that's 11,000 affordable homes that could be unlocked.
It's an unbelievable.
It's a lot. I mean, perhaps this is for the entire panel, but why is that the case? And I wonder, how can we facilitate that growth and bring forward those new homes?
I'll jump in. Sorry, just before Aaron, I think we need some actionable delivery routes for it. Why can, and we'll come on to it, but with the devolution bill, if a local authority or regional level have a decision-making power, why can receipts that, or why can't receipts that have been collected through through contribution from one site that it's not physically possible to deliver affordable housing or a significant quantum of. Why can that not be directly invested into a neighbouring private development to increase the quantum or increase the quality of that affordable housing?
All right.
Go on, Aaron, go on.
This is unlovely, because I'm going to disagree with Andy a little bit on some elements, yeah? The reason I disagree is because, I've got massive respect for planners and the mayor and the complexity of what they are trying to achieve.
You know, which isn't easy at all.
Measure what it must be like trying to square this circle.
Absolutely.
It's incredibly difficult, right? And it's complex. Of course there's complexity. Of course there's challenges. There has to be, because they're trying to create a city that's going to be viable for the next 10, 20, 50, 100 years.
And one that's inclusive, that really brings people along.
We'll come on to inclusivity in a minute, right? So why do I disagree a little bit with Andy, and also developers in general? And I say that as an investor, that has significant capital at risk. If I buy a piece of land and I overpay for it, it should not be the council or the taxpayer that bails me out. I should have to just get on with it, yeah? It's my fault for being an investor. That's the up and down. What people don't realise, I think, well, certainly the general public, is not all developers make money, let me tell you. Not many of them, certainly very few of them, make money through a cycle, through an economic cycle and through a real estate cycle.
Why do you think there's a perception that developers are? I mean,
I can tell you why, because when was the last time you read a newspaper article that said developer is unsuccessful? You'd never read it, right? All you see is developer makes money, developer does this, developers whatever. Yeah, let me tell you, it's incredibly hard work. It's incredibly complex. It's incredibly risky. But that's the life we're in.
Yeah,
we are putting capital at risk. So therefore, I like the fact that the mayor says, come out and says, it's not about viability. 35% level playing field, or 50 on public land, get on with it. And all that does is it tumbles down to residual land value. We buy in at a level, we either make it work or we don't. That is the risk. That is the risk reward. It shouldn't be the council bailing us out by using viability. Sorry, it doesn't work at 35%. It only works at 10 because I overpaid.
So why do you think, and this is a Kat's point that she made a few moments ago around this 20% of something. What does that mean? Can we explain that to our listeners?
I understand that, because if you're...
And that's in reference to affordable housing, potentially, to facilitate growth.
If you're a developer and you don't have to sell, and you can't economically, it's not economically viable to develop, you're basically going to sit there with the land. And therefore, you're not developing, you're not delivering. So Kat's argument is not, you know, is a sound one as well. Yeah, but at the same time, I don't think wholesale that the taxpayer should bail out an unsuccessful development. I think that's something inherently wrong with that. So therefore, as an investor, if I got it wrong, I will have to trade out and take my bets and hopefully make it up on the next one. That's why
I'm going to have to allow you to respond, and then perhaps I'll bring in Kat, Andy.
I think I don't agree with the sentiment at all. I think in true viability, when you come down to the detail of the factors, and take land value out of it for a sec, you know, true build cost and value of that affordable product obviously underpins the development itself. So I think that the value piece is an interesting one, and something that we're looking forward to the budget next week, looking at social rent levels and a local housing allowance, because ultimately, you know, we need to make the affordable sector institutionally investable again for a number of reasons. But the government can make some quick changes in terms of looking at those social rent levels, increasing them, hopefully, so they're truly discounted market facing, but also looking at surety of those over the next 10 years.
But let's be honest, Andy, there's very few parts of London where it's not economically viable to develop a residential development that has 35% affordable in. There's very few. I mean, economically, most of them make sense.
We'll bring Kat in here. I'm enjoying this, by the way.
It's very great. Zero land value.
Yeah, the thing is, so I'm not a viability consultant, I'm a planner. So all I hear is that developers can't do 35% or can't do the 50%. And then I do see we get permissions for them, for those schemes, at 35% or 50% to get through the fast track, get the decision quicker, and not get stalled through liability and everything else that goes on with that. And then they can't deliver it. So why can't they deliver it? Because something's not viable. But the thing that I think, there's elements of a scheme that you can't be flexible on because they're to do with climate change or building regulations or fire safety. Those elements which cost, you can negotiate on, but you can negotiate on affordable housing or affordable workspace, so those affordable elements. And I'm not pro it, but that just seems to be what I hear as a planner, what we need to negotiate on, and that is the way to make it deliverable.
I don't know whether it's the deliverable or more profitable.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes there is confusion with those two elements.
Yeah.
It's not deliverable, it's more profit. Yeah. And so, look, we know what developers can do. We know one of their strategies is to bank a planning consent and then try and nuance it to make it more profitable. So, look, I get the argument, but a level playing field should be a level playing field. And I think that the challenges that planners have, are huge. That's why there's complexity.
Mm.
There's complexity because what a developer wants and what a city wants sometimes are two different things.
Quite.
Yeah, and so, look, the planners, and whether they're town planners, city planners, or local planners, they're the custodians of our city. Because once, certainly on a residential block, once they give a consent, it's probably there forever.
Quite.
It's built well enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's another thing. If it's built well enough, it's there forever. So therefore, they are custodians of our city. So they have a huge amount of challenges that I think sometimes developers also underestimate, also they don't take into account. Because look, they're looking at a development appraisal and going, how much can I make out of this? How much more can I make out of this? And so that's where I think the divergence of strategy comes from.
Well, do you know, on that point, and I have to say, I've just had a text from Pat and our team, who's helping us, an engineer today, and he said, this best discussion yet, and I completely agree with him. And just on that point, actually, I wonder... And I do agree that town planners, city planners, our planners at large are the custodians of our city. I wonder, how do you square that with the, in my view, rightful kind of liberalisation of our planning rules? We're not just looking at simplified planning sites or zones. We're actually looking to make it easier to build. Is being less prescriptive a good thing? To your point, or do we actually need more stringent regulation that is just going to stymie development? That's
right.
Me playing devil's advocate.
Okay, so the way I'm going to answer this is to wrap in affordable.
And I will bring in Andy and Kat as well, because I'd like to hear their opinions.
One of the biggest challenges for me, and I've lived in London 53 years, right? And
that's a surprise, by the way. Anyone who can see Aaron, you wouldn't believe him.
53 years, and let me tell you, London looks better every day. It looks better than yesterday, it looks better than the day before, it looked better than the day before that, yeah? That I have got no nostalgia for London in the 1980s and 1990s, let me tell you, it's a much better city now. But it has headwinds, right? And so the biggest headwind for me is affordability, right? And because, believe it or not, I had a delegation in from the Nordics today, 22 people talking to me about town planning and master planning because of the challenges they have. And one of the things that I talked about was social inclusion. Yeah, we do not want areas of London that is socially imbalanced, one way or another. That's not London to me. London has huge amounts of positive things going for it, for the fact that we have got massive, large green spaces.
Absolutely.
That we are blessed to the monarchy for, because the king back in the day went, you can have the cheap part of London, you can have Mayfair and nice street, but I'm keeping that part.
And look at those areas now, they've kind of blossomed. I mean, they have Labour MPs, for goodness sake.
So we have amazing parks in this city, right? Number one, we've got heritage, we've got history, we have urban sprawl,
quite,
which I love, right? Because there's surprise around the corner. You know, we don't live on a grid system like they do in New York. We have urban sprawl. But the biggest challenge we have is affordability. Yeah, we want mixed demographic living in our buildings, living in our different areas, and I think that is why local and London government are being really strict on this. And I think it's for the benefit of the city long term, which is that we have mixed demographics, we have social inclusion, and I think Section 106 has been actually one of the success stories of my time, certainly being a real estate developer and investor.
Can I just bring Kat in here, just on that point, and back to the question that I asked, which is a relaxation what we need, or do we need to be more prescriptive? And I'll come on to Andy.
It is a hard question. I don't know if we need, we definitely don't need more prescription. I don't know if we necessarily need a relaxation. We just need to simplify with what we've got, and perhaps be clearer at that national level about the priorities and what we need. And you know, we are talking about housing here, but say industrial land. Say, I think that is confusing to councils about what we need, where, and why. And so I think you just need, it's more at that regional and national level that you need more guidance and strategy and you know, forward thinking. But just to I suppose connect to what Aaron said, I think we are capable of working within the system that we've got and make exciting places. And one of the schemes that we've worked on in Waltham Forest with yourselves actually is a co-location scheme. But
is this Uplands?
It's Uplands Business Park, yeah. And it's great. It's 1,800 homes, 30,000 square metres of industrial logistics space. Quite creative, but it's got a new open space. It's really opening up the waterfront. And yes, it's one landowner, and that's, you know, there's not loads of them. But again, I did name quite a few at the beginning of this podcast. So, and I think there is, and that will have 35% affordable housing, and we are capable of being able to create these places. Again, I'm the planner, not the developer, I'm not the investor holding the purse strings.
I think it's more challenging regionally when you are talking about negative land out and trying to make it. So I think one of the points you made earlier, does Birmingham drop its requirements down to 20 because it needs to get building? Mm-hmm. Yeah? And because then it actually doesn't, it's not working at the moment. So I get that. But then also, the other lever to pull, because there are other levers to pull, the other lever to pull is like Homes England at the moment. There's a huge momentum behind Homes England at the moment and Peter Denton. And one of the levers that they can pull is grant money. To get areas moving, because they're sometimes not economically viable because of all the reasons we said earlier, which aren't insignificant. I'm not downplaying them at all, which are new building regs. Why are new building regs there? They're there because we need them. We need to build better homes. We need to, you know, why is it the Victorians and Edwardians can build homes for 150 years and we can't?
Absolutely.
Right, yeah. Why? Because we've let our standards slip. So we need standards to improve, to make sure that we're not reinventing the wheel every 20, 30, 40 years, yeah? We can build homes for 150 years. Why not? It's not impossible. So we need to do that. That's why we need regulation in place to make sure that our standards do not slip. And then you can use grant money to get areas moving and then get them shifting and then become economically viable. Other things you can do, like infrastructure, HS2, we won't go there, but as a country we need to wean ourselves from the over-reliability on London.
And we are anticipating the Chancellor setting out her debt rules and whether or not either it's the OBR that will kind of monitor that or how we calculate our public debt in order to finance potential infrastructure projects. I wonder, Andy, if I could ask you to kind of wrap up this section around, do we need a relaxation of our kind of planning rules, or should we be more prescriptive? And perhaps for the whole panel, very succinctly, what international examples would you say are good in terms of facilitating good growth?
I think I very much agree with what Kat was saying about we need more clarity and guidance at a regional, national level in terms of what the outcomes need to be. and make that a common theme across the country so we all know where we need to go. But we've got the devolution bill, which we touched on briefly earlier, but bringing the specific decisions down to a localised level, and that's not just coming down the way, it's also bringing it up from some of the smaller decision-making parties that might be involved. We talk, Aaron touching on regional decision-making. You know, sometimes we work in county council with district councils, we're delivering affordable products within a district council, going to them for planning, but it's a product that sits part of a wider county council affordable housing programme. So it's also bringing things up from a more local level up to sort of a regional level to bring those decision makings there. But if we're working within a framework, you know, there were six more, I think, areas signed off under the bill last week. It gives us more continuity in decision making, more breadth on that, but also allows it to be specific to the locality.
Thank you guys for that insightful and exciting discussion in that last segment there. And actually talking about discussions, so we know that planning and redevelopment often comes down to local conversations, those one-to-one conversations that we have Consilio facilitate, but yourselves, Kat, Andy and Aaron are often having your own fields of work. It's probably showing my politics here, but Labour together recently released that up to 5% of the public are known as hard NIMBY, as in those who are opposed to development, or to coin the phrase, not in their own backyards, with many voters, around 15 to 20%, so one in five, are not willing to support developments unless local infrastructure, concerns about local infrastructure like GPs and health services, when new housing developments are proposed, are included in them. Demographically, 83% of those aged between 18 and 24 said that they would be persuaded by at least one argument in favour of new housing, compared to just 52%, so just over half of those aged 65 and older. NIMBYism is stereotypically associated with age. I know that from our work at Consilio, we try and find new and innovative ways of reaching non-traditional participants to engage and to demonstrate their support in proposals across age ranges. A question for the panel. How do you handle situations where, or how have you handled situations where political pressure and community opposition conflict? Does it differ? Perhaps a kind of simple question here, but does it differ with the size and scale of the scheme? And have you ever pushed back against local arguments that could determine a scheme's viability?
You've been naming that. Right, I'll have a go. Okay. I think what this, for me, comes down to is absolutely about engagement. Yeah, again, it's one of the points I talked about this morning with my Scandinavian delegation was, if you're, certainly on larger scale projects, one of the ways that you get, certainly, I wouldn't say community buy-in, but certainly community engagement, is engage them at the start. Now, you're going to be imposing yourself on the community, depending on the size of your scheme, sometimes up to like 10 or 15 years. There's got to be something in it for them. Yeah, you're an outsider. You're not living amongst the rubble, the lorries, etc., etc. You're not living there. You know, you're living elsewhere if you're the developer, let's be honest, unless you're the... So therefore, you're going to be imposing yourself. And if you're imposing yourself on a community, there has got to be a vision in it for them. They've got to feel like they've got a voice. And certainly in my investing lifetime, I would go back to 20 years ago, they weren't even consulted. They weren't even brought along for the journey. They didn't have any input, any voice. They were just seen as not important. Yeah, and that needs to change. Yeah, of course it does. It makes absolute common sense. If we're going to be imposing ourselves on you, what's in it for you? What can we give you? And Andy will tell you that we're working on we've worked on big schemes together where we've actually gone out, we've employed consultants to find out what the local community needs. What is it you need? What is it we can help you with? And if you get that kind of engagement, then you've got at least a chance that they're not going to be totally against you.
Mm.
It's still going to be a challenge. Of course it is, but at the same time, if you engage them and if you sell a vision to them that if you live with us, I promise you, we will deliver this for you. And that's why I think people like Argent are fantastic at what they do. Yeah, because they have walked the walk. If you look at all their schemes, they do the infrastructure bit first. Yeah, they'll do the parks first. They'll do the community bits first. You know, and I know that one of the things we were going to talk about is how we take lessons from other places.
Mm.
I don't think we need any lessons from anywhere else. No one, I don't think anyone does it better than us. We can do it better. But no one, if you look at the things that I've seen in my lifetime, I've seen the regen of Stratford, King's Cross, Brent Cross now, Wembley.
Incredible places.
All these areas, yeah. And there's more to come. You've got Old Oak coming, Canary Wharf even in my lifetime as well, yeah. So let me tell you, we can do large-scale projects like this. I don't think we need to take lessons from anyone, but I think we need to improve and get better at what we do.
Thank you so much. And I think it is that point that, although we referred to blockers, or I did a bit earlier, it's actually about, rather than having residents be the passive recipients of top-down decisions, it's putting them in the driving seat and allowing them to...
Driving seat, I'll stop you there. Certainly, if it's the driving seat, then yeah. There's certainly engagement with them so they feel like they've got some input, yes.
Absolutely. And Wanda, Kat, and then Andy?
Yeah, no, I'd absolutely agree that vision is key. You have to have a vision. There's definitely been a few times working on projects where the vision hasn't been absolutely clear from the outset, and that's made it harder, especially on schemes which maybe aren't very pretty. The moment I'm working on a multi-story industrial scheme, which could be up to about 50 metres, and it's a shed, it's a couple of sheds, there's nothing much you can do there with it. But you have to have a vision, you have to make that tangible to the community. There is residential in fairly close proximity, so it's this isn't going to look amazing, but what is it going to deliver? How is this going to make London better? What's going to be in here? It's first of all not a waste plant, it's not going to be noisy, but what could it be? Is it, it's going to get your milk delivered a day quicker, or, you know, it's making it tangible. But I also think about the working at the outset for us as planners, I think obviously working with a good comms consultant is helpful.
Absolutely.
But I think it's, especially on strategic schemes, it's having in London the GLA, but then everywhere the LPA on board at that political strategic
Absolutely,
level
yeah.
from the outset, because they are going to help you politically. And I've had a much easier time on schemes when that has been the strategy from the start. I've not ended up at appeal and been able to have a nice, you know, fairly nice ride through the planning process when you've had that political backing at the start, and that is a developer that's got a vision and understands that that's what you've got to do before you pre-app it, before you do anything.
Yeah, and it is around, and this is what I often advise my clients, but where we see the industry moving towards, it's working in tandem, both with political leaders and actually those on the ground, so ward councillors that either live in those areas or are really in touch with their constituents. And also speaking to residents and community groups to make sure that, and I would say that, Aaron, that they are in the driving seat, or at least they're co-pilots in what you want to try and achieve. And I think to Andy, what is your view here on how you make that relationship work? And have you been in a situation where sometimes local demands could perhaps undermine schemes' viability that we've spoken about at length today?
So, as Aaron mentioned, we're fortunate to work with a lot of clients who see the value in the community benefit piece. But I think to add to it, it's not just about delivering a thing. You know, a benefit isn't a park, or a benefit isn't improved transport. It's how that integrates with that community as well. And Kat touched on it there. You know, what tangible benefits does it bring? And sometimes to get to the nub of what the true benefit is, we engage with everyone, but sometimes it's not the most vocal people who actually give you the golden nuggets that give you an understanding of how a community goes together. One scheme we're on with Aaron, we've been doing some data analysis recently around demographic and communities, but then we did a follow study, which sounds a little bit creepy, but you stand and you literally map out what type of people are transitioning across the site and around the site. And that showed us that a huge number of accompanying kids go around this site daily at different times, which didn't come up when we did the data analysis. So that will shape our proposals going forward and become a big part of that. and allow that sort of seamless integration into the community without making, you know, we don't necessarily make big statements about it, but we add that to the daily life of their children. They're now coming through a space that's valuable to them and they use it. So you've got to really get to the detail of it. And I think the last piece is the integration works both ways. Whilst we're delivering benefit to that community, we're also bringing potentially a lot of new people to that area. So it's about making sure that the existing community and the new community have that opportunity and it's facilitated for those to blend together. And looking at the uses we're putting into developments, making sure they're complementing what's already in the area and making sure that that transition is smooth and it feels natural for someone who's lived there for 30 years to be part of the new development and vice versa.
It's about being the phrase I often quote in client meetings and speaking to residents, it's completing that jigsaw. What does that community look like? And back to Andy's point, London has progressed, and I'm fortunate enough that in the last, God, I'm not 30 yet, but nearly 30 years, London has evolved into a place that I love to call home and want to continue calling it home, and I think is perhaps one of the best cities on earth. Just to conclude and to end, and we'll be putting you all on the spot here. If you had one ask of the new government, and we're a week or so out from the budget, also from the Mayor of London, to improve the planning and development space in London.
So our government ask is, and I've mentioned it a couple of times, so sorry to repeat it, is the devolution thing. Really providing a framework where we get clarity of outcomes through a lot of work on the NPPF at the moment, obviously. Housing targets, their realignment of those, sustainability agendas is something we've touched on again today. But giving ourselves that strategic framework to work towards and having relatable outcomes that mean something to everyone in the community, every stakeholder, and giving that sort of oversight. But then bringing the decision making to a regional or more localised level, providing the skill set to do that. And that decision making, as the devolution bill sets out, across planning, funding and economic growth and the allocation of funding that we've touched on as well, and allowing areas to integrate with each other and have a wider strategy, but actually deliver across the timeline on the specific needs of the area.
Thank you. Kat?
A couple of things. Well, one's more of a statement, but in terms of my ask, it would be to ring fence planning application fees and planning performance agreement fees. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about resource, and that's another reason why planning application development is being stifled, because there's not enough resource to deal with it. And a way, it would go some way if those application fees were ring fenced. But maybe more of a statement, it is there's been a call out from the industrial sector. I think you've probably heard I do quite a lot of industrial work through this podcast. For more of a spotlight on that sector through government, and we are seeing the green paper that's just been published on an industrial strategy. So it is good to see that coming through, and an ask is to actually see that be implemented and more of a spotlight on there.
Aaron.
All right, mine's going to be broader, which is to harness the positivity and the momentum that we currently have. If we don't blow out the candles next week, then I think we are the confluence of the momentum that we have currently, with interest rates coming down, values going up, more people wanting to buy. But don't forget, we've got probably 3 years worth of pent up demand of people that have continued to rent that want to get on the housing ladder. Right? So with the interest rates now definitely on a downward swing, that makes it more viable. I just think that the momentum is there. We need to don't blow out the candles, just grab the momentum, and we should build our way out of the malaise that we found ourselves in over the last, and not entirely government's fault, let's be honest. We've had to deal with a lot of headwinds that were external factors. So I don't underestimate their challenge, but I feel like they are trying to pull the right levers. If they get the balance right, then I think we're in for a really good period and an exciting time.
Thank you so much, and what a great note to end on. I'd like to thank our three wonderful guests, from Andy Cox, Kat Fraser and Aaron Taggart, and Patrick Ginn, who sat through and listened to quite a lively conversation today. My name is Sidhu Dwyer. Thank you so much for listening to the Better Places podcast, and we will see you again in the next episode.
Well, that's it from us. Thank you for listening to another episode of Better Places. You can listen to our back catalogue of episodes at conciliocomms.com/podcast. And don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform you listen on. Bye-bye for now.